Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Kotayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deepest understanding of Japanese cuisine. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Phoebe Ogawa, who is a wagashi chef based in New York. Wagashi means traditional Japanese sweets, and they are quite different from Western-style sweets in many ways, such as the ingredients, how it's made, and the occasions they are served. And somehow, we don't see wagashi outside of Japan very often, even in big cities like in New York, despite the popularity of Japanese food. And Phoebe is one of the precious wagashi ambassadors abroad. She was classically trained in Japan and now communicates the essence of wagashi through her stunningly beautiful sweets to New Yorkers. So today we'll discuss what wagashi is, the differences between wagashi and Western-style sweets, different types of wagashi, how Phoebe studied wagashi, the challenges she makes wagashi in New York, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan is available on Heritage Radio Network, a website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Phoebe Ogawa. Hello, Phoebe. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So this is exciting because since I've seen your work, I really decided I have to have you on the show. So welcome.
So, thank you so much.
Yeah, so to get to know you first, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
So I was born in the U.S., but I moved quite quickly to Canada. So I grew up in Vancouver. And Vancouver is quite multicultural. So I very much grew up eating a lot of food from many, many cultures, and primarily, of course, Japanese food at home through my mother's cooking, but also just the culture of Vancouver leans quite heavily, actually, to like Asian and Southeast Asian foods and cultures. So I grew up eating Indian food. I grew up eating a lot of Cantonese food, Chinese food, Thai, Vietnamese, and even when I go back to visit, that is primarily what I like eating when I'm visiting as well.
Right. So your palate was trained for diverse tastes and flavors. That's amazing.
Yes, I've never been afraid of trying anything new.
Right. Okay. And so perhaps most of our listeners are not familiar with wagashi. So we'll discuss your background, everything later. But so first, what is wagashi and what is the difference between wagashi and Western style sweets?
So wagashi is a very traditional Japanese style of confection. It's made primarily from rice flour, beans, sugar, and water. It dates back hundreds of years. Usually, as historically, they were served as part of tea ceremony, which is very formal. Nowadays, it's a lot more, very, very informal now. It's very easy to find in Japan. And I would love for it to be as easy to find here as well. It's one of my main goals is to try and raise that awareness and make wagashi more of an everyday sweet as it is in Japan.
Mm, right. So so when I grew up, there's a very local wagashi shop, and there's one particular pink-colored mochi style sama. And whenever I go to the shop with my parents and my brother, that was my go-to sweets. And my brother had something else. And everybody has favorite style because wagashi is so diverse and everybody can be accommodated by just one shop. So that's a very different idea of no cream, butter, sponge. There's so many different variations. That's, to me, that was a big attraction to even go to just to look at the wagashi. But yeah, so the plant-based, that's the big difference, right? Because you don't use cream butter like Western.
Yes. So it is quite, like, historically, it is very, it does not use, like, dairy. It doesn't use egg. There are, of course, wagashi is composed actually of many cultures that have come into Japan, and Japan has taken it and made it their own, and that's what wagashi is. So, like, thousands of years ago, like, sugar came in from China, and it was more of a kind of like a medicine. Like, sugar wasn't something that was easily found. It was very expensive. It was inaccessible to many people. It was just for the rich and the privileged, and they were able to enjoy sugar, but only mostly as a medicine. And then, so we have the Chinese influences. We also have, later on, the Portuguese and the Dutch influences. And they were the ones that brought in, especially the Portuguese, they brought in eggs, they brought in dairy, they brought in butter. And wagashi, there are wagashi styles that do incorporate eggs and they incorporate butter, but primarily it is plant-based due to the history of Japan being based on Zen Buddhism, for example, which is, which does not, and it's not meat-based culture.
Mm, right. That's interesting that, you know, human beings call it medicine, whatever it's tasty, like alcohol, sugar, then make it something special for rich people. So Japanese wagashi also. But yeah, so what is the history? You just kind of touched on many different moments of wagashi history, but can you maybe summarize when it started and how kind of path it has taken up to now?
Yeah, so there are many aspects of wagashi, like even just the most simple or one of the more basic forms of wagashi, like a manju, which is like a bun. So it's a bun that has some kind of filling in it. So, and like usually in wagashi, for example, it would be filled with red bean, azuki bean, which is, of course, plant-based. But even that bun is based on a meat-based bun, which used to contain, like, meat, a meat bun. And because of that Zen Buddhist culture, they've replaced that red meat with a red bean. And even yokan, which is a type of jelly, that was based on, like, cooking down meat and the blood and the bone. It's like a stew of meats and that kind of aspic jelly that is made from the bones and the gelatin that's contained in the bones and the blood. Like, that jelly to make, that is made again, once more, like plant-based by using agar and red bean as well. It still contains that red color from yokan, from that aspic jelly, but they've taken it and made it into a dessert with the red bean. And everything is based on these, like, Chinese influences that they've made, that they've brought in and they've made into their own, which is the Japanese wagashi. So yokan still contains, for example, the character for hitsuji, which is sheep, which so it was made from that sheep's meats and sheep blood, sheep bone stew. And that's why it still contains that that character even now. So you can still trace that history through the thousands of years, up, even up to now.
Interesting. That the original version of meaty chili sounds very nutritious, but I think that there's an influence. I think the Buddhism, right? Like Shojin cuisine, which is plant-based. And in Japanese history, after 7th century, everybody started to be not eating meat because of the emperor Tenmu banned eating meat. So there's another influence, probably historically religious aspects in Japanese style plant-based food, which was, of course, a mainstream up until the end of 19th century. So that's an interesting thing. So that's a history. And then you said gradually it used to be expensive sugar and started to be more available. And then going beyond rich people or tea ceremony, people started to eat wagashi more widely in the public.
Yes. So sugar, even there is the difference also in sugar. Like dagashi, which is like that everyday wagashi, uses kokuto, which is the dark brown sugar, primarily, like mostly. And jonamagashi, which is the kind of the tea ceremony grade wagashi that uses white sugar. So everyday sugar was for everyday people, and white sugar was reserved for, in fact, for the imperial court. And so Kyoto shops that were designated wagashi shops, they were the only ones who were able to use white sugar to create their sweets because they were serving the imperial court with these traditional sweets. And so they also were able to enjoy a much higher status in the class system as well because of their ability and their skill in creating these sweets with white sugar and having that privilege of being able to serve the imperial court with their wares.
Right. So that visual color only used white sugar and the flavor and refined taste. Also, do you think because they're serving to the imperial court, they really became beautiful, like visually elaborate?
Absolutely. So the imperial court is not just made, of course, with the emperor. There are many women who were part of the imperial court, and they of course enjoyed these sweets very much. And so even just being able to show off their skills with colors, with shapes, with textures, that was very much a way to differentiate themselves again with even other skilled craftsmen.
Right. And I think other very important part of wagashi is the seasonality. So like everything in Japanese traditional cuisine, seasonality is very important, and wagashi is not an exception. So could you tell us about the importance of seasonality in the world of wagashi?
Absolutely. So many of the shapes are based on nature. So, and many of the ingredients are based on crops and whatever is in season at that time. For example, in the fall, there are many wagashi that use sweet potato and chestnuts. And in the spring, there's sakura mochi, which uses cherry blossoms and cherry blossom leaves. And even in the texture, for example, in the summer, you want something refreshing, so a lot of jellies are prevalent in the shops for things that are available in the summer. So the seasonality, it reflects not just in the shapes and the colors, but also in the ingredients and the textures and how they want and they believe people would like to enjoy them. I mean, it's the same in Western cultures in terms of, like, of, you know, enjoying ice cream in the summer rather than in the winter. But having grilled and smoky flavored things in the winter is much more pleasing. And so they really want to showcase, for example, having the shapes of the seasonal flowers. It reflects the shop windows. You would have these wagashi, for example, of flowers. And right outside that shop, you would see that same flower blooming outside as well. Like, it has that parallel with the wagashi shops and whatever is blooming outside the windows, whatever is in season in the fields, as well as, for example, even in the calendar as well, there are different celebrations, and these celebrations are also based on the seasonality of things as well. But there are specific wagashi that are eaten for certain celebrations, and just even seeing that wagashi would evoke for that person, oh, it's that time of year again. Like, it's an immediate kind of visceral reaction of seeing the wagashi and realizing what time of year again, or how fast the days have gone by, and they can reflect back to the last time they saw that wagashi. So it's very, you can really track the calendar by just looking into the shop window of a wagashi shop.
Right. And for example, if you go to a tea ceremony, the practitioner or the host makes his or her own wagashi for the specific seasonal occasion theme. And it's such an amazing coordination, right? The teacups, flowers, and hanging scroll with poetic calligraphy in the room. And the wagashi is another highlight. And I'm looking at your Instagram page, Ogawagashi, and I saw this June, that's the hydrangea. And it's, I don't want to even eat it because it's so pretty, and the color veined and the flower. It's just stunning. Like, you don't want to touch it. At least you have to take tons of pictures before you touch it. So, yeah, that's amazing. As you really think that, you know, it's just a sweet, but it's not. It's the season. And as you described, Phoebe, just wagashi, to me, maybe I'm biased, but it has so much in one piece of sweets. So anyways, I just carried away because I'm so excited about this, your work.
Thank you so much.
So, but, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there are many types of wagashi. And you said that, you know, it's a diverse, reflecting the history where it was influenced by originally. So what types of wagashi are there? I mean, there are millions, but you can pick some traditional, you know, classic ones that maybe our listeners can try.
So even in just that kind of, for example, I believe that there's everyday wagashi, and then there's the jona magashi, which is the more formal wagashi. Like in, I think that's best reflected, for example, in Kyoto. Because it's the only place, even in Japan, that differentiates the two, even with the shops. So in Kyoto, they have mochi manju shops, which is the buns and the everyday wagashi shops. And they are classed differently than the jona magashi shops, which cater to the tea ceremony grade wagashi. It's the only place in Japan that does that, even just a little bit away in Osaka, for example, or even in Tokyo, a lot of wagashi shops serve both. They have the mochi manju and the jona magashi, and they provide both types in their shops. In Kyoto, it's the only place that has mochi manju shops specifically, and then the jona magashi shops again.
Right, best of the best kind of mindset.
Yeah, so the mochi manju is more like very much that everyday wagashi, dango, which is upon, which you can find actually as an emoji symbol, that green, white, and pink balls on a mochi balls on a stick, for example. But those are the everyday kind of wagashi that you can, for example, buy on your way home, for example, to enjoy with tea with your family, or even just by yourself, you can enjoy the dorayaki, which are two kind of pancake, sweet egg-based pancakes with red bean inside and sandwiched in between, or manju, which can be steamed or baked. It's the jona magashi that is what I believe, I think people are less kind of, they know less about, which is, which is actually currently my bread and butter. That is very much my, that is my goal, is to kind of raise that awareness for people here to be able to enjoy not just the flavors of wagashi, but also the beauty and how how they could enjoy the beauty and the seasonality of wagashi through jona magashi.
So what are the most popular ingredients of wagashi?
The base ingredient is the beans. So it's either azuki, red bean, or white bean. It would be tebo or shiro azuki. Shiro azuki is white azuki. It's either red or white bean based. In here in the U.S., it's very difficult to source tebo mame, so I'd use something in the same family. It is a type of lima bean, so I would use a white lima bean instead of the tebo mame. So one of the hardest things about making wagashi here is, of course, sourcing ingredients, either if the same ingredients as I could find in Japan, or at least something similar that could replace it. The other thing that is very difficult to find are the tools that are involved. There are many traditional tools that are needed to create wagashi. So that is the other challenge I have here in making wagashi.
First, let me ask you about this, the azuki bean paste, which is very unique. And then I want to talk about the different textures you can create from the same beans, right? So maybe koshian, tsuguan, that kind of thing. Can you maybe explain to the listeners?
Absolutely. So I like to explain it kind of like, at least in American terms, in the Western terms, as like smooth and crunchy peanut butter. So it's like tsuguan is like that crunchy peanut butter. It's textural. So there's whole bean. It's more of a whole bean jam. So it's like it's cooking down the bean, but keeping the skins and everything, and having that kind of chunky whole bean flavor as well as texture. Koshian is a smooth red bean paste or jam. So it's removing the skins and just using the bean inside and cooking that down with sugar and water. So it's a very smooth taste. It's a lighter flavor as well because you don't have the flavor from the skin in it. But that I do you like using peanut butter as a kind of an example of how you can differentiate between the two, koshian and tsuguan.
Yeah, interesting, right? The same beans, but the whole texture and the length of finish, like how long the taste lasts, that's completely different. So,
absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so in Japan, I think it's great to be able to find, of course, you can go to tea ceremony, but, department store basement, that's the Depachika, that's a famous food court every department stores have. And it's the whole thing in the wagashi, like jo namagashi style, very sophisticated one, to some more casual, the castilla, the dorayaki, to those yokan. They have different versions. And also, of course, in supermarkets and some convenience stores carry at least one or two good wagashi as well. So wagashi is available in Japan, and it's plant-based. If you're vegan, vegetarian, most likely you can eat them too. So yeah, I think it's going to be more demand for wagashi in the future. So hopefully Phoebe, keeps going and then educate people how great it is, how beautiful it is, how it can be, wagashi can be a good occasion to celebrate the season. Just stop the moment, have a cup of tea, and your life is better. So,
absolutely. Yes, my biggest goal, my biggest objective in making wagashi here in the U.S. is education. It is to raise the profile, to raise the awareness of wagashi. As you said in your introduction, like sushi and ramen, all of these Japanese cuisine is so recognizable. Now, I would love to elevate wagashi in the same way, to and not just have it as just mochi or mochi ice cream. I want it to be something that people can find anywhere and all the time, as you can in Japan as well. Mm-hmm. So that is absolutely something that I hope to achieve.
Right. And we didn't mention, but traditionally Japanese wagashi tend to be handmade, like you do, Phoebe. And they don't use mixers or something very machine-driven, which is great. But in terms of wagashi, it's more like kind of craftsmanship required in terms of good flavor, traditional wagashi. And even teisumuni practitioners, they make their own wagashi too. So there's a soul in it from whoever makes it. And that's another big part of wagashi, which is relevant in Japanese food culture, I think.
Yes, like the craftsman kind of indelibly leaves their mark with every wagashi they make. Everything is handmade. It is fortunately and unfortunately difficult to kind of mass produce. But I would love for people to learn about it and then perhaps even try and find out, for example, of ways to make it themselves even, or just to even take a moment to learn more about. And that's, I think, is the goal here as well.
Right. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here. And then when you come back, we'll dive into how Phoebe classically studied wagashi in Japan and the beautiful wagashi she makes in New York. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Phoebe Ogawa, who is a prominent wagashi chef based in New York. So how did you get into wagashi? And do you have any moment of revelation to start loving wagashi?
So I absolutely had zero knowledge about wagashi. Of course, I would visit family in Japan as a child with my parents, but I didn't really know or even enjoy wagashi until I was much older. I had a friend actually in New York City who decided that she would try her hand at making her own mogashi at home. And I was only there as really just for fun. I've always enjoyed baking Western sweets, so cakes and cookies. So I've always had an interest in that aspect of cooking, but I'd never tried or even imagined that I would enjoy making wagashi. She tried for an entire summer, and I tried along with her. She stopped, but I kept going. And it was in a moment in my life where I'd stopped to think what I wanted to do next. And I decided to give myself a year where I can do whatever I wanted to, and then just have a moment just to myself. And I decided that I would go to Kyoto and learn how to make wagashi. And at the time, there weren't very many online resources, for example, so that I could learn on my own, as you can nowadays. But so the only way I could learn wagashi was to go all the way to Kyoto, essentially, or just to Japan. And I thought, why not Kyoto, which is the birthplace of wagashi, in at least in the formal sense. And here we are. Instead of the year, I took another even further year to continue my studies, and then a little bit more, and I just kept going.
Wow. And, you know, you decided to go to Kyoto, but this is a big decision. And I heard you really pursued a very authentic path to study, right? So what kind of did you go to school, like specialized in wagashi making, or what kind of a course was it?
Yes. So as a Westerner, I didn't understand how to go about learning wagashi. So I took a very kind of automatic, oh, there should be a school for it kind of approach. So I did my research. I looked up schools, and I chose a pastry school in Kyoto. But when I got there, I wasn't so happy with the amount of wagashi that we were able to learn at school. So just 2 weeks into my course, I went out and I started to go to shops in Kyoto and try and just learn from them directly. I continued my school studies, but I also made sure that I would be training at these shops as well. I was fortunate enough to begin work at a shop about a month into my time in Kyoto, and actually that's where I stayed until I left Kyoto to come back to New York City. I had both kind of the formal training in both senses of a, kind of a curriculum, but also the hands-on training and being able to see the process of wagashi being made from beginning to end in a large number in a shop as well.
Mm, right. Sounds like the most efficient way to study something very special. So, and then after that, you used to make wagashi in New York for the now closed but very popular cafe called the Kokage. And in Manhattan and upstairs of Kokage was the Michelin-starred Japanese shojin or plant-based restaurant, Kajitsu. So how did you get involved in Kokage in New York?
So I was quite lucky. It was very serendipitous. But when I was in Kyoto, I had friends from New York City who actually worked at Kajitsu, not in the kitchen, but there was a chef there that worked at Kajitsu in the kitchen, but also had some friends who worked as servers at Kajitsu, just very randomly. But it was quite fortuitous, I was able to meet the owner of Kajitsu, who lives in Kyoto. And it was through him that he actually invited me to return to New York and to work at Kajitsu as a pastry chef there. He really also had the same kind of vision where he wanted wagashi to also be something that was more known in the U.S. as it is. And he wanted that path to start at Kajitsu.
Mm, right. So unfortunately, it's his the owner's decision to close Kajitsu, but now you still keep making a beautiful wagashi. So where do you make your wagashi now?
I currently have a kitchen in Long Island City in Queens. I provide wagashi to a Japanese market called Mogumog Market in Long Island City, as well as through a lot of tea ceremony events in the city, both Omotesenke, Urasenke. There are a lot of tea ceremony events now happening, and now that the pandemic has kind of slowed down, everyone is like starting up again. There are lots of events happening, a lot of tea teachers and their students coming together again, and there is more of a demand now for formal wagashi. My understanding was that there were a lot of wagashi being made by either the tea ceremony teachers and tea ceremony students. But I believe now they are kind of looking, they are still continue to make their own, but they also, for larger events, for example, they've now started to ask elsewhere, and that elsewhere it happens to be is with me.
Mm. Wow, that's exciting. So I'm sure once someone sees your sweets, they want to try work with you or buy your sweets. So what can we taste? Our listeners can taste your wagashi.
I provide wagashi to the general public through Mogumog Market. I strive to kind of change the menu often so that people can continue to come to the market and try something different every month. I also work with some tea shops, and that includes Kettle and Greenpoint. Their flagship store is in Greenpoint, and we are working together to, and they are providing wonderful teas from Japan, and I am providing them with wagashi on the weekends, fresh wagashi on the weekends, for people to try along with their teas. Mm. Their goal, I believe, really overlaps with mine. Theirs is in the education processes of their education in Japanese teas. And my goal is, again, with people, for them to learn about wagashi. So I love that our goals there are overlap. And so I really love working with Kettle Teas.
Mm. Right. So Zach Mangan, the owner and the tea master, some way, he came to the show twice in the past. And so you're going to have an event at Kettle in Brooklyn, Greenpoint Group Brooklyn, in July, on July 8th, that's Saturday. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Zach at Kettle, he invited me to come and do a workshop with him. He will be emceeing the event and serving teas alongside my wagashi. He really loved the idea of making the wagashi fresh for the customers and in front of them, so they are not just able to enjoy the wagashi itself, but also the making of the wagashi in front of them. And I really loved the idea. Like, I usually am in my kitchen and just kind of like making the washi by myself, and just I'm perfectly fine without an audience. But I really love the fact that maybe then people can see the various tools that are used, and the various kind of like shaping movements, and ogashi, as like anything else, tastes delicious when it's freshly made. So I'm really hoping that there are more opportunities, like at Kettle Tea in July, for me to be able to showcase not just the wagashi itself, but the process of making wagashi as well.
Right. So how carefully you make with hands, that's also, and then at the end of the work, what you see is like a gem looking beautiful sweets that you can actually eat. So yeah, so again, it's a Kettle. As Kettle is that they have website is KETTL.co. I think that's their website. And that's on Saturday, July 8th, 3 times, 11, 1, 3 p.m., 3 times a day. Yeah, so I know that Zach went to Japan and spent like half his time, 6 weeks, and then he brought back a lot of interesting tea as well. So, yeah. Okay, and so what is the biggest challenge in making wagashi and selling wagashi in New York?
It is actually for people to know what wagashi is. If they don't know what it is, they won't not come and seek it out. So it is kind of telling, it is that it has a very low profile. When I go to events, for example, and I have this opportunity to show wagashi, like 90%, 99%, no, I don't even know, but such a large percentage of people who approach me, they approach me because they see the wagashi and they're curious. And they're curious because they've never seen it before. And if not for that event, I'm not quite sure whether they would ever, or how long it would have taken them to even know the word wagashi. So it is very much a challenge in awareness. But once they do learn what wagashi is, the challenge then is for them to convince them to try it. Beans are not something that is enjoyed in the Western culture to be sweet. It's very difficult to tell somebody or try to get somebody to try beans that are sweet because they are so used to having them in a savory context. It's not so attractive as as an ingredient as, for example, like cake or butter or dairy, so as an ingredient. So it's very much an education challenge, for sure.
Right. Well, once you're told what it is, it may be hard to, it's a thought process. But whatever I eat wagashi, it's so light, gentle on my body, and I don't feel heavy or anything. And it's just the quick energy I get. And ready to go, kind of really clean, light sweets. So that's why I really like about it, and goes well with coffee. Who actually are eating your sweets right now?
And so Mogu Mogu Market is actually a wonderful outlet. The customers that come to the market come to seek out like a sushi ingredients, and a lot of the Japanese ingredients that they are that people in the US are very aware of. And they just happen to come across my wagashi. So a lot of customers at Mogumogu are very much first-time customers to Wugashi as well. Otherwise, it's very... it's either you've never seen it before and you're trying it for the first time, or you are part of the... or you are Japanese and you are here in the U.S. and you really miss Wagashi and being able to access Wagashi. So I get a lot of feedback from customers who are Japanese who are just so happy to be able to have Wagashi again in their lives. And that really makes me happy. I'm always nervous because they know exactly how Wagashi should taste because it's something that is very familiar to them. So I never really want to disappoint them if it's so different from what they remember, what they're used to. And one thing I can share is that a lot of Westerners, when they go to Japan, they try Wagashi there for the first time. They are usually a little bit surprised. They kind of feel that the Wagashi is sometimes too sweet, for example, in Wagashi in Japan, which may surprise some Japanese people because they might feel that Western sweets here in the U.S. are so sweet. And it's a different kind of sweetness, I believe. Like in Western sweets, you have like other things, not just sugar, that's in these pastries. There's butter, there's dairy, there's eggs, and they kind of cut the sweetness in flavor. So even if you have the same amount of sweet sugar in either a wagashi or in a Western sweet, it might feel sweeter in the wagashi just because there's nothing to cut that sweetness. It is just purely the beans and the water and the sugar. It is a very pure sweetness.
Right.
And for me, it's very much a personal preference, but I also like things to be a little less sweet. So the wagashi I make, indeed, it does contain less sugar than the traditional recipes that you may find in Japan for the same wagashi. So it's not really an effort of mine. That's not like my goal is to use less sugar. It's just a preference for myself. And I think that may be due to my own upbringing here in the West. And even just a personal preference, I just like things a little bit less sweet. So my wagashi is a little less traditional in that sense that it uses less sugar as well. Mm-hmm. So it does feel less sweet. Yes.
Right. Interesting. In other words, you directly taste wagashi sweetness because there's no cream or butter, like the fat element that coats your tongue, which is another joy, but wagashi is something different. And I know that there's a big company like Minamoto Kichoan in New York, and they sell wagashi too, or Toraya that used to be here. But if listeners go to Japan, going to any supermarket or convenience store, well, most likely, I think listeners will be excited to see the department store food court. They really showcase beautiful wagashi, and then that's where people can probably find how special wagashi is in the Japanese culture. And again, it's not just the sweets and taste; it's the seasonality. Like you said earlier, it's this time of the year, and it's so visually beautiful. And also, Japanese gift-oriented culture. Oh, this is so beautiful. Let's buy it for someone. And as a gift, to look at the smile of the person who receives it. So that's very very social and the celebration of life kind of thing. So, yeah, I think wagashi is not just the equivalent of sweets in any other culture. In Japan, it's the context of whole society, life. I don't know how I can explain more, but it's important, right?
Yes, it's like also like a striving for a common experience because like they share the same culture, they share the same kind of traditions. They see something that evokes something in them, and for example, in seasonality, and they want to share that experience with somebody else, and they would, for example, bring that piece of wagashi of like you mentioned before, the hydrangea, and they might bring it through the rain because it is the rainy season that hydrangea blooms in Japan, and they would go and visit a friend and they would bring that hydrangea wagashi to them, and they can enjoy the hydrangea that are blooming outside in the rain, and then enjoy it inside as well with the wagashi, and then they can talk about how they hope that the rainy season is soon over, about how hot it is getting and how summer is really approaching so quickly. They can share that kind of, and have that common experience to share just through having that wagashi together.
Hey, even rainy season, it's not so bad if you have beautiful wagashi.
Exactly, yes.
Right. So, the wagashi changed your life, but what's most exciting about making wagashi to you personally?
I do love the kind of discovery that people, like seeing that sense of discovery in people when they have it for the first time. It's very rare to be able to share something that people have never had or have never experienced in this, like, in this kind of age where the internet is prevalent. They can find anything they need to online. But yet you can bring something to their lives that they've never seen before, they've never tried, or even if they have seen it before, they've never had an opportunity to try. So I really love that sense of discovery that I could see in my customers and people who come and seek it out, either through the market or through kettle or even through a tea ceremony that they were invited to. So that is absolutely my biggest joy.
Right. And in Japan, we see more innovative wagashi chefs as well as chefs who work hard to preserve beautiful traditions. So the examples of innovative wagashi can be non-traditional, visual, powerful presentation, and some addition of new ingredients like chocolate, which is exciting too. So how do you predict the future of wagashi inside and outside of Japan?
So I personally, I think as both an insider and outsider, I am I'm ethnically Japanese. My parents are Japanese, but being born and raised here, I have kind of this sense of wonder in the traditions, the traditional part of wagashi. I love using traditional shapes. I love using the traditional colors of the wagashi. So a lot of my designs are very, very, are just very traditional. They're very much based in old forms and old forms and shapes of the wagashi from the past. I think that isn't going to change. Like, there's a reason that these shapes have continued and they haven't died off. That is, I think, the tradition, part of the traditional. Japanese people love tradition, and I think that isn't going to change. But as you mentioned, there are the ingredients, for example, the use of ingredients are changing. Traditionally, wagashi isn't flavored, but I personally like to flavor wagashi with fruits and seasonal fruits and ingredients from here in that are local, that are seasonal. I might use like peaches in the summer, for example, and or cherries, or just all of these beautiful seasonal ingredients that you can find here. And it is absolutely a way to entice people to try wagashi, because I can use the kind of familiar element of these seasonal ingredients to try and entice people to try wagashi for the first time.
Mm. Right. Well, that's exciting. But the essence of Japanese cuisine is always seasonal and local, sustainable, what's available. So it sounds like really pushing the envelope of Japanese wagashi here in New York. So so what are your plans and dreams? I mean, you mentioned your dreams to educate everybody how special wagashi is. Any plans on your mind?
I like this path I'm on currently. I love being able to provide wagashi in smaller kind of batches, be able to see my customers directly. I really love that. I like being able to make wagashi at my current scale, being able to see customers through the market, and then being able to work with other business owners directly so that they can use wagashi and serve wagashi to their clientele as well.
So it's, especially younger generations are looking for plant-based everything, and wagashi is perfect. And also visually, you can be creative. If the new wagashi chefs are going to be born in the city, they can be very creative, and I can't wait to see them, what kind of creations they really started to do. So, and I think you're the source of inspiration, of course. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
I make sure, or I'm trying my best to keep my Instagram page updated with all the seasonal wagashi that I serve every month. Sometimes I'm able to kind of provide special sets or special seasonal celebrational wagashi that you can find at Ogawagashi, Ogawagashi. And that's on Instagram.
That's cool. Yeah, your Ogawa last name and wagashi, you combine it. Ogawagashi.
Yeah.
Okay. That's awesome. Right. And the kettle, you're going to have event on July 8th. That's kettle, K-E-T-T-L, no E, K-K-T-T-L.co. And Mogmog, the supermarket, people can go get PB's wagashi. It's M-O-G-M-O-G, one word, Mogmog. That's the one you can just look up in Long Island City. So, yeah, this is exciting. So keep me posted. Maybe you can come back and discuss more, because wagashi is such a big topic and it's not enough to cover in one episode. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time. It was absolutely my pleasure to be able to speak with you today.
Right. So good luck, and I look forward to tasting your wagashi more in the future.
Thank you so much.
Right, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikotema.com. Japaneats is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as our podcast. My engineer is Liam Warner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Japaneats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates, to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.